Ciao, benvenuti. Welcome to Choc Tops and Cassata, the podcast that takes a peek into the way migrants got their fix of Italian movies from World War II to the advent of SBS in the early 80s.
This is a Secret Life of Language podcast from the School of Languages and Linguistics at the University of Melbourne. I'm Elisabetta Ferrari, lecturer in Italian Studies at the University of Melbourne.
I'm Mark Nichols. I research and teach in film in the School of Culture and Communications at the University of Melbourne.
And I'm Santo Cilauro. I'm not a lecturer in anything. I'm a writer, I'm a filmmaker, and an unashamed connoisseur of all Italian B-grade movies, regardless of where they were made. Sicily, Calabria, or way up north in Naples. Our special guest today is, well, where do I start? He's an Oscar and a BAFTA nominee. He is a writer, he's a director, he was a teacher as well. Amazing work. I'll go through the biggies: Shine, The Notebook, Mao's Last Dancer, The Secret River. This man is the closest we get to cinema royalty, I think, in Australia. Please welcome Gian Vittorio Sardi, AO. Gian, thank you so much for joining us this
Grazie.
Morning.
Grazie. Thanks, you, Santo. That's lovely. Thank
it's
you.
Such a thrill,
pleasure
isn't it?
Pleasure to be here. It really is.
Gian, we do want to talk about Italian cinemas here in Australia. That's what this podcast is actually about. But before we do that, let's go through a little bit of the Gian Sardi story. Where does it all begin?
It all began in 1927 when my grandparents migrated, both maternal and paternal, migrated from the island of Elba. On my father's side, my paternal side, they were up in Queensland cutting cane and all of that. And I'm really compressing this, as screenwriters must.
good editing on the run.
Stories, you know. And then when the war broke out and Japan attacked, they came down to Melbourne, 1942.
That because it was a little dangerous up there for them?
Well, because Italians were being interned up there. Great deal of racism. There was a newspaper called Smith's Weekly up there, which had sort of little cartoons, which saying, you know, Papa Minestrone, you know, hiding in the cane with a gun and all of that sort of stuff. If you look it up, it's kind of fascinating. So they came down to Melbourne, and I was born 11 years later, basically. I've got an older brother. And when Dad first came down, he was only about 13 or 14. He started work at a place called Mario's in Exhibition Street, which was a big Italian restaurant, which had floor shows on a Sunday night. And we sort of grew up pretty much in the restaurant, and they used to have big floor shows on Sunday nights. So maybe that's where the show business bug got me. I'm not sure. And I grew up in Carlton, in Drummond Street, Carlton. It was a very different time then, certainly in the 50s and 60s, Carlton, and just a little few streets where we lived. It was a little Italian village, really.
So growing up, you were in this environment, this, I guess, restaurant slash entertainment kind of world. And your father was obviously central, quite famous there.
Yeah.
So was that your connection to the outside Italian community? Did you go to the Italian cinemas? What was your experience growing up in terms of watching films?
My experience watching films was basically the midday movies and that Sunday movies.
On the TV?
And then on the telly. Yeah. And then going to the movies probably every Saturday to see a Western or at the Adelphi, which is now what became the San Remo Ballroom in Nicholson Street. That was the Adelphi. You would go there, like, you know, the Saturday afternoon matinee. And to tell you the truth, I was never aware of the Italian cinema experience. In the early 60s. The life around Carlton then, in terms of the cultural side of it, it just revolved around those few streets. And I would go visiting with my grandfather pretty much on, you know, every Friday night, Saturday night, we'd go to someone's house here or we'd go to someone's house there. And occasionally there would be an Italian dance. So I was never really aware of the cinema experience. And I suspect some of that has to do with the fact that it was a sort of a generational thing. I mean, when my grandparents came out, like they still had silent films, basically, you know. And so probably the sort of cinemas and the films which started up in the 50s and 60s was part of the legacy of the second wave of Italians, or could have even been the third wave of Italians, I think,
different,
you know,
generation.
That came in, you know, that came in. And so they were looking for a connection, you know, to home, and it was all very familiar. And they'd, you know, probably gone to the movies in Italy, whereas my grandparents' generation, you know, they didn't go to the movies. The only movie I went to see, I went once as a kid, about 8 years old. My mum was taking me to see Old Yeller, which is a Disney film. It wasn't Italian. my interest, I guess, in Italian films came from the angle, that film sort of cinematic path. And so then I started to appreciate them and start watching them in that sense, you know, and really fell in love with, you know, what I was seeing. And I thought, my God, how did I miss this, you know? I loved Westerns, and that was, yeah, I mean, my whole experience was pretty much Hollywood, or there were some of the Italian dub Westerns, you know. I went to the Plaza Ballroom, and I think I saw How the West Was Won 5 times, you know, because that's what you were doing. It was just every Saturday. I'm going to go and see that again. And as a kid, you know, I'd just jump on the tram, bring someone along, maybe a mate, you know. And I remember seeing the odd film would turn up on television. Like there was a, I remember Sophia Loren in The Two Women. And
La Sciocciata in Italian.
That's right. Yeah. And so Bicycle Thieves, I discovered that later. Like all of the classics, I guess, I discovered later.
In your directorial debut, I don't know how many you've directed, but, you know, in Love's
one.
Brother. One.
Yes.
Okay, was it? There's a Sophia Loren scene.
Yeah,
in that,
that's right.
Which is quite amazing. I actually didn't even know the movie. What is it called?
Boy and the Dolphin. Yeah.
Oh,
which,
my goodness.
And I'd seen that as a kid.
Okay, you
so
had.
So the Italian movie connection for me really was Sophia Loren in what was basically American films. And then I knew there was an actress called Gina Lollobrigida, you know. And
she came to Australia.
And she came to Australia.
She did, yes.
And I think she went to Mario's at some point.
I suspect she would have. She went to a soccer game because my dad escorted her to a soccer game.
Oh, wow. Whoa.
So, John, let's go back to Love's Brother, which came out in 2004. It tells the story of two brothers of Italian origin living with their extended family in County Victoria in the mid-50s. And it's interesting because the film talks about the practice of marriage by proxy. And amazingly, between 1945 and 1976, about 12,000 women migrated as proxy brides, which is extraordinary. And often they only way these women had to get to know their husband or their future husband were some letters and photographs. So Jan, did you have to do a lot of research for this film?
You know, Love's Brother took me on this amazing journey, and a lot of it was sort of culturally biographical. I mean, it's a story which was a sort of a magical sort of realist type story. When I went up to Queensland in the 1980s to do some research about the cane cutters and try to find a story there, I was still a school teacher at the time, mind you, and I thought, well, maybe I can tell the story about the Italian cane cutters and that. And someone told me this story about a guy who'd sent his brother's photograph, and I always remembered that.
Is there a reason why the film was all in English?
Well, with Love's Brother, I mean, apart from, I mean, I'd wanted to shoot it in Italian, which would have been great, you know, but you would never be able to get a film like that financed. But it was this amazing journey, which I got to shoot in Italy on this village, just not far from Rome, actually.
It did look very beautiful.
Yeah. It was kind of stunning, you know. And one of the great highlights of that trip, apart from shooting the film and all the experiences it took me to, and there was another one after that, was Andrew Lesney, the dearly departed Andrew Lesney, who just won an Oscar for Lord of the Rings. He was the DOP on it. And he said, come to lunch at Cinecittà. And I said, really? Oh, wow. He said, yeah, we're having lunch with Vittorio Storaro. And I just thought, and to me, that it still feels like a dream.
Let's talk about Shine, which came out in 1996. It's a film based on the life of David Heathcott, a brilliant but troubled concert pianist who was born in Melbourne from a Polish family that had migrated to Australia. Now, the film was directed by Scott Hicks and was nominated for 7 Academy Awards, including Best Picture, Best Screenplay, and it actually won Best Actor with Geoffrey Rush.
Was that an original script? I know Scott Hicks had been working on the story for a while.
Yeah, he'd written a script based on a lot of research, and then after a while he realised that he wanted a different take on it, you know.
Okay.
And a lot of it was to do with structure and finding the real story and how you knit it together. And so I sort of restarted the writing process, but collaborating with him as a director
and trying to
say, okay, what are you trying to do here? What is it that you want?
There's a few images in that film that I suspect maybe hark back to influences that were possibly Italian movies or other kind of movies.
Yeah, well, I can probably...
I do remember a phone ringing.
It's a long time ago, so yes. I can admit to this. And the other reason I can admit to this is because Quentin Tarantino has built a career out of ripping off Sergio Leone. Right?
It's called Homage.
It's called Homage. That's right. And Sergio Leone is someone... I'd seen the films before, you know, Fistful of Dollars and all of that. But where I actually got blown away was when I saw Once Upon a Time in America. Mm-hmm. And to me, it was a film which was like a dream, you know, and it goes for 4 hours. And it's just like you're not conscious of time at all. And I went and saw it, and I saw it again, and I saw it again, and I saw it again. There's one scene in it where this phone just keeps on ringing and ringing and ringing, and you want, after a while, you're going, will someone pick up the bloody phone and answer it? Mm. And you know. And so in Shine, there's a scene where David collapses on the stage over this after this massive performance. Now, in real life, you know, he did have a mental collapse, and you know, this was all in the research. And then he went into a mental hospital or a hospital in London, and then you know, then he was sort of had to be shipped back to Australia and all of that. And look, and it was kind of like, how do I get from there, from the height of this performance, you know, back to Australia really quickly, mm-hmm. because that's the next most interesting part, you know, and a lot of the seeds have been set up for what is to come because the Geoffrey Rush character was, you know, the part of the character had been established early. So I just suddenly I heard this phone ringing when I was writing, and I thought, okay, there's a phone ringing. There's a phone.
Sergio Leone's calling.
And then, and so
homage
everywhere. You see, homage is you only steal from the best, as you would know, Santo, right?
No, of course not. I would never do that.
And so the phone starts ringing, and I thought, okay, you know, he's going to contact his father, you know, and so I'm back, you know. And so I had the phone ringing over his face, you know, collapsed on the stage, and then it kept on going, and it just rings and rings and rings and overwhelms the soundtrack. And next minute it cuts to a phone, and you see a finger come in, and someone dials a number. But he's actually having
electric shock treatment.
Electric shock treatment, yeah, which is how they did it in those days.
With a phone.
With a sort of roller phone.
You stick your finger in.
You stick your finger and you do it like, yeah, okay, this is a really serious one. We'll give him an 8, you know, or you know, okay. We'll give him a 3, you know. So, and then it cuts to a phone actually ringing, mm-hmm. which is what happens in Once Upon a Time in America.
And he's back in Australia.
And the hand comes in and picks it up. And it's his father answering the phone, and he's back in Australia. So it all happens in the space of about
that
a minute and
fantastic.
A half. And it was just that compression that when you're writing a biopic, generally it's best to take big leaps in time, as long as you sort of don't disorient the audience and they know, you know, they're comfortable. If they relax in your hands and they know, mm-hmm. you know, once you make them feel comfortable, then they don't have to go, what's this about? What's that? And often you get with biopics, you can get just bogged down with.
I love that story. I really do, because it's, you know, we were saying homage. And to me, that is actual homage. Mm-hmm. You're not saying, oh, that's a good device. I might use that because that's handy. That is literally, they're almost signs coming down saying, yeah. No. That's good that thought came to you because it fits.
Yeah.
I think that's amazing.
Yeah. No, I was blown away when they were giving you the shock treatment. Because I wasn't aware of that when I wrote it, that was the device that they would use.
Wow, there you go.
And so it created another sense of anticipation. Yeah. And then you go, no, you're going to have to wait a bit longer now. You
know? That's the best type of homage.
So... I just wonder how much there is of your own personal experience in the first couple of movies that you wrote.
Sure.
The one that they are starring Vince Colosimo.
Oh, Moving Out.
Moving Out and Street Hero.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, in Love's Brother, really, you talk about your own personal story, and it's more about the first generation of Italians that arrived, whereas the other two films are more about... a second generation. And so I wonder if that's something that is your own personal experience or more from observation.
Yeah, I think with Love's Brother, it was sort of more a cultural thing in terms of the story and research that I'd done, but also knowing certain characters in it. You know, there were stories that I'd heard. So it was stuff that I'd carried with me, and people used to visit our house in Drummond Street, Carlton, characters who you would go, I can use that character, you know. Whereas with Moving Out, it came more as part of my story, I guess, was being a teacher at the same school that I actually went to. Right. So I ended up at that school as the first drama teacher, the all boys school, St. Joseph's College in North Fitzroy. And what was happening there just sort of fascinated me. And I would just scribble notes of scenes of things that would happen. Like, you know, I'd go be walking home from, from teaching, and there'd be a car that had been abandoned and all the kids were hanging out in the car. And I thought, that's really, and then eventually the car just got stripped, you know, over a period of months. And I thought, that's kind of fascinating. There's something. And so I dropped that down. You know, then there was stuff which was much more connected to the Italians back in the 70s, where there was a little bit of, you know, cultural cringe for the boys. You know, it was, oh, you know, I don't want to be Italian. And they would go home and they would speak the Italian, the parents would say something to them in Italian, you know, and they would answer in English. And they say, oh, parla italiano, you know, like speak Italian, you know. And then there was things at parent-teacher nights. You know, there was this wonderful scene in that one of the teachers who didn't speak Italian, like I do, that at a parent-teacher night, he said to the, he was trying to explain to a father that his son was doing really crappy, you know, crappily, basically, you know, your son's really bad. And he's just not doing well. Could you? And the father's just sort of sitting there nodding, and he knew that the father didn't understand a word that he was saying. So he called the son up, who was in the at the back of the room, and said, could you please explain to your father that I'm not very happy with you and, you know, that you need to improve and all of that. And so the son comes and he starts explaining to his father. This is how the story was told to me. And the father sits suddenly, gets this big grin on his face and starts nodding and goes, oh, bravo, you know. And then so he knew. And it's interesting with moving out with that scene. They wanted to subtitle it, you know, the roadshow at the time. They wanted, and I said, no, you can't subtitle this film. And I've written the whole thing on
the
basis that.
You're telegraphing, yeah, no.
Yeah. And I said, but that, you know, but what about all the Italian? I said, you know what they're saying, because of what the kid is saying back to them in English. That was how it was all structured. And it was my first script. So I didn't know it would see the light of day. And I never thought that I would probably ever write another script. I don't know. I just sort of had fun sort of doing it. And I met a young director, Michael Pattinson, who was great. We became mates. And I would tell him these stories, you know. And he said to me, have you got any ideas for a film? You know, because he was with another, he was developing something else. And I said, oh, yeah. I said, maybe a short film. And he said, well, just write it, you know. And I ended up, I did a scene breakdown and it was about 160 pages by the time I finished. It's not a short film. He said, but we'll just keep cutting it until it feels right, which we did, you know. So it was more from my teaching experience that it reflected, and I knew what was happening in the homes. And at the time, a lot of the Italians had, you know, they'd come out there, they'd worked hard, and they would be coming upwardly mobile, and they were moving to Doncaster.
Was Vince Colosimo, who stars in Moving Out, was he a student of yours?
They all were, pretty much.
They all were?
Yeah, pretty much. I think just about every single one of them
was. So did you suggest to the director that Vince play
the
part? No,
well, Vince, I'd left teaching that school. I taught Vince in year seven. I was the first drama teacher that turned up at St. Joe's. At the time, he was just like this little rebel who would sit there and go, this is bullshit, everyone, right? Just don't do it. Don't do it, right? And he'd go and sit up with his back against the wall and go, I'm not doing it, you know. And so Vince, at the end of the year, he almost wears this as a badge of courage, right? And he says, I failed him. I'm the only student that he ever failed, because he refused to do stuff, or he would just make a mess of it on purpose.
Yeah.
And he used to say, what job's this going to get me? True.
That's a great story. Jokes aside, how did Vince actually get into acting?
He was at St. Joe's, and then
did the drama course.
Yeah, and then Michael Pattinson, the director, came out to the school and met some kids. But then I'd moved on to another school. I'd moved out to sort of Eltham, and I got a job working out there. And it, like all films, they always take a number of years to get financed or whatever. And a couple of years later, we were still had been working on the script and trying to get the finance up. And then Michael says to me, oh, we found this great kid at St. Joe's, because he kept up the relation. And I said, who? And he said, Vince Colosimo. I said, what?
Oh, no.
But I knew why, that he would be perfect. I just knew.
Had Vince gone to Rusden or some acting school or anything?
No. He was only, years old at that. Well, when I taught him, he was about 11 years old.
So the director went to St. Joe's and asked,
The film got financed and all of that, he went there and reconnected. And I sort of put him in touch with the people again. And he went and started auditioning kids.
You were responsible for that casting, really, when you think about it.
Yes.
I don't think that connection would have been made had you not
failed him. Yeah. No, well, this was it. No, all of the kids in it, pretty much, with the exception of one or two, you know, because they, you know, sort of like they bring a roll call of kids in. But so they went there, and all those kids were kids that I'd taught literally probably 18 months earlier, you know. And so at the time, I think I said, but he's too young, you know, because he was only about 11 then, you know, and in the movie, Gino in the film is about 13, 14. And Vince was 13 at the time. And Mike said, oh, no, no, he's, you know, got quite a bit bigger. You know, I sort of said, oh, he's just a little shit, you know. Not
now,
really.
Now
sorry,
he's a big
Vince.
Shit. Yeah.
Now he's a big shit. No, wow. No, Vince is great.
He's great.
And the beauty of it is exactly the character he played and even characters that he's played since, that's Vince, you know.
And he's played some amazing roles.
Brilliant roles, yeah.
Amazing.
And the two films, really, they I think highlight this idea of being rebellious for various reasons, though. And I think that cultural tensions of being Italian and being, you know, children of migrants is very evident.
There was that, the other sort of biographical element there, which was another interesting part of the research that I did, which involves Carlton and waiters and restaurants and all of that, was back in the 50s and 60s, there was a place called L'Alba.
Yes.
Right? And there was a little thing that used to happen upstairs. You know that, right? Yeah. Your dad probably told you about that, right?
He never partook in those.
Yeah,
those,
my dad did. Big time.
They sound like fun.
Yeah. Card games.
It was a casino, basically.
And every now and then, dad knew all the cops who used to come to Mario's at the time. And he knew the head of the vice squad or the alcohol, whatever that's called, you know. And they would get a tip off, you know, if something was going to happen, you know. And there was a guy who was and there were little peephole, and you would open up the little peephole if someone was coming up, when someone knocked on the door, and they would let you in if you were there to gamble and play cards. And if it was the police, there was that bell would ring and everyone would turn the tables over and coffee cups would come out and they'd all be just sort of sitting there.
As if nothing ever
happened.
And that's
it. But in Street Hero, there is a scene where you see that.
Well, there was a place in Ligon Street at the University Bar. It's still there. And my grandfather used to play cards there. In fact, I was there. My grandfather always used to say, why are you so mean to me? I brought you up.
Yeah.
And I said, no, you didn't bring me up. I just sat on your lap while you gambled all day and I passively smoked 60 cigarettes a day. That's not bringing me up. Anyway, this is one step above the Alba. And I can say this because I'm sure statute of limitations allows this because of such a long time ago. But when the cops came, the guys didn't turn the table up. They just moved up because the cops played.
Oh, right. Okay.
They literally came in and played.
Yep.
And I'd be there going, am I really, even as a little kid, I would have been no more than five or something, even then thinking, is this really happening? There are two policemen, one's playing and one's just sort of standing there. But they were great days. And I'm clearly not as prolific a writer as you are, Jan, but I've written my fair share of stuff on the screen. And all that stuff that floats around in my head, it's inspired me. Whether patently or latently, it's there.
Yes.
So I co-wrote a film called The Castle, and to me, it's a very Italian film.
Yes.
People say it's the most quintessentially Australian film I can think of. And I sit there and go, isn't that funny? Because I think of it as the opposite. I think of it as a very Italian film.
Yeah.
So is there any of that distillation going on in your head when you write, when you wrote, when you think about things? Do you think that it sort of seeps in somehow?
Yeah, I think it does. I mean, you're always putting yourself into your writing in some way, you know, probably mostly unconsciously, you know, you're doing it, you know.
So with Mao's Last Answer, it's a novel.
Yeah.
You know, but you're making it a screen experience.
Yeah.
Do you think that some of that stuff sort of has to trickle down?
Yeah. If you look at the sort of things that, you know, I've sort of generated myself or the things that have appealed to me, even like, you know, The Secret River, it's about a guy who comes in and he has to find a place, you know, and work out the world that he suddenly finds himself in, you know. And so it's an interesting sort of question, I think. But generally, I think, you know, good writing, you always put yourself in there and part of that self sometimes involves ripping off ideas of films that you love.
Homage.
You know?
Come on. Homage.
Sorry, yes, homage.
Well, but if we look at that idea about not only personal experiences, but we've talked about Leone and other films, how consciously do you respond to memories of films that you or experiences. I mean, I was having a block the other day and I couldn't get anywhere with something I was writing, and I was watching The Dish, and all of a sudden I got fired up to get into a certain, you know, that kind of literal relationship, I think, is
Yeah,
really
I know what you're saying. Yeah, no, well, sometimes I guess it's not as conscious as that. It's just the sort of things that you know that you like, and things that have in some way you've responded to or have given you. They just sit within you, I guess. Generally, when I get stuck or something, I find music and a lot of soundtracks that I listen to and music that just try to capture an emotion, you know, try to capture a certain sense of something. And so there's something about music, which is, you know, and certainly the classical music of the Italians, it's, you know, the great operas and all of that. Yeah.
It's interesting. I had a chat with Giuseppe Tornatore, who wrote the Cinema Paradiso. Yeah. And he said that when he worked with Ennio Morricone, they did the music before they did the film. So that therefore he played to the actors. This is the music that when you walk into that room, that's the music playing, which is such a smart thing to
do. De Niro would not do that famous scene in Cinema una volta in America without the music playing. He said, "I've got to know what you're playing," and that's how. And it's like, and it becomes a choreographic experience as well. Do you indicate musically at all? At any level of the
writing?
No,
not really. No. You try to make the script, you know, fairly sparse, the rhythm of it will tell it. And it's rare that you'll say, never really. Music swells here. You know what I mean?
No.
People aren't feeling it, you know, whatever. You know, you want people to be feeling it as they're reading the script, and it's the journey that you take them on. But that's the great thing about, you know, music and film. You know, they're very similar. It's all about the light and shade, the rhythm, just the way in which, you know, little themes are introduced, and then eventually they start to bounce off each other, and then finally it all comes together at the end, you know. And it's that sounds really easy, but when you're writing a script, you know, as you know, it's hard to pull off, you know. But music, it's the closest thing, I think.
Well, the start of Mean Streets, it's incredible soundtrack. Yeah. It's just that sets up the movie, doesn't it? I'll ask you just a very, I guess it's a related question about inspiration. I guess it's a cousin of do you bring your own experiences to it? But because I think I do it inadvertently, and that is I'm aware of the common experience of people watching a film and a cinema as I'm writing. Yep. So therefore, I know what it's like when I'm writing co-writing The Castle or The Dish. I know what it's like to tell that story to people in a cinema, because I've sat in that cinema. I've watched Gladiator 7 times in a cinema full of people gasping and doing like, I know what it's like. Do you think of that experience?
Absolutely, the
cinema experience.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, yeah. To me, that's what it is. It's almost like you're sitting there in the cinema and you're writing, and I'm seeing it, you know, you try to conjure it up in your mind. And your focus is always, what is the audience thinking and feeling at this point? And in some ways, to get yourself into that headspace, you've got to place yourself almost in that place of looking at the cinema, you know. And what I, the one of my probably favorite experiences, once you've sort of finished a film, it's all right, it's great going to the premiere and all of that stuff and whatever. But my favorite thing is going to the cinema, because I know the film backwards, and watching the audience.
Fantastic.
Isn't it fantastic?
It's unbelievable. You know? When it goes well.
Yeah. When it goes well. You know, I remember doing that when Shine was at Sundance in 1996.
God, I could just imagine.
And that was a spellbinding thing because people were literally holding their breath, and you could see it, and you could hear people sobbing here and there. And it was kind of like, I thought, wow, these Americans are really sensitive, aren't they? You know, but it was just, you know, really just, it was the film that did it. And so you love to sit there and watch the audience, because that's why you sort of do it, you know. And that's how you know if it's working, you know.
I mean, the thing is that I think it's such a privilege to be a storyteller.
Isn't it?
But the thing is that it doesn't mean very much, does it? And if you've got no one to tell it to, or people listening to it and going, it's whatever.
That's right.
So it is such an important thing. Yeah, I wasn't there, but we had the same experience at Sundance for The Castle.
That's right, you did too, didn't you?
The Castle, because we didn't know that the film would travel. Yeah. You know, you had no idea. We knew how it played when we played it to our own families and things, and it went down well. But it's a pretty special kind of feeling when you're around and you can actually hear that audience.
Yeah.
then writing stories about, Italian leaving Italy and migrating, you really tap also into this idea of nostalgia or representing a country that you belong to, but you're far away, and so you have got all of those notions also. But do you think that there is something in that idea of nostalgia that you tend to represent?
Yeah. Well, in Love's Brother, it was, there was the fresco where there's being painted a fresco. And so there's scenes where they're looking at the fresco and they're dreaming. And there's one character who was based on a guy who used to come to our house in Drummond Street in Carlton, and he'd come out early. He would always complain about how bad Australia was, and I'm going to go back one day. One day I'm going to go back, and it's so much nicer over there, And so one day he went back, but Italy had changed.
Yes.
Right? Mm. And he came back and lived in Australia and died in Australia,
amazing.
And so I created a character in that where there's a guy basically, complaining all the time about, I'm going to go back on the boat.
Which is a very common story, the idea of going back to a notion of a country, and that's what nostalgia is, and finding that it had completely changed.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting because I guess it depends where you came from, because some people came from such abject poverty that it's the last thing on their mind.
That's it,
my grandfather, he lived till 98, was never interested in going back to Sicily. Never. He went back to Brooklyn to visit family and Argentina to visit family, but not Italy.
Went to Italy, yeah.
And my dad, I guess he's 95 now, the same. Even though they're terribly nostalgic, we had an artist, his Gino Alberti, used to come to our place and paint on the exactly like in the film, Italian landscapes on our lounge room wall.
Yeah, I know of someone, Gualberto Genei, who's still alive.
Okay,
a lovely man, and he would go around and on the electric light boxes at the front door of the house.
Oh, my God.
He would paint the scenes of Italy, I visited him just over Christmas. I went and saw him, and he's a lovely man.
But
he's still painting,
Is he still? Wow. Oh, that's a good business. That's
great, yeah.
But I find that amazing that my father would still want all these paintings of Italy on the wall, and he was so crazy about Italian coffee that he would wait for the ships to roll up at the docks. We'd go on board so he could have a coffee in the bar on the ship.
Oh wow!
That he said, "No, this is Italian coffee." Yet he didn't want to go back.
No, but it's interesting this idea of recreating here that perfect Italy through the paintings, the coffee,
exactly.
So the smell, the taste.
Yeah,
but. Yeah, and recreated that sense, I think, of nostalgia of a place that is far away and you might not decide to go back anymore.
Yes. That's why you wanted to go to Italian cinemas, I guess.
Exactly.
I'm going to the Italian cinema. I don't need to go back to Italy. Yeah. I can do that here. So the whole thing also about your grandparents coming to the Canefields, I know I've spoken to Paul Kelly, the musician, about it. Like his grandmother was involved up there. I don't know how close they were with your grandparents, but... I think every year or so they put on an opera in the Canefields.
Yeah, that's right. Apparently his family was.
So imagine that. I mean, you couldn't have a cinema or anything. So I'll do an opera in the Canefields.
Yeah, yeah.
Just to recreate that.
They had to sort of create their own, memories.
Jen, how did you, get this interest in Italian cinema?
I was at university or teachers' college, as it was in the day. And I'd been a projectionist. I'd gone and worked at a company after playing in a rock band and working in a men's store. I ended up going, because of the love of cinema, there was a place called 16mm Australia. It became Bell and Howell in South Melbourne. And they had a library there of like 500 films. And in those days, no such thing as DVDs or streaming or anything. There were film societies all around the state, all around the country, really. And they would hire films on a weekend. And I got a job working in the dispatch area of this library. And every weekend I would take home films, and a big projector in those days. And I'd hang a sheet and get some people who'd come around and we could watch, Ben-Hur and throw things at the bad guys and all
that's
of that.
Amazing. That's fantastic.
And it literally used to do maybe three or four films a week. And then every now and then you'd come across a film because I would also be a projectionist and go to screen films for other people. And then you'd see something and suddenly a door opens up and you go, oh, that's interesting. Mm. I hadn't really gone down there. I hadn't seen that. And probably the biggest influence in terms of opening up my mind, if you like, was when I was studying, Tom Ryan, who many would know was a film critic, and he worked in the film department there, and they needed a projectionist on Friday afternoons. And so he was showing foreign films, and I would sit there, you know, as the projectionist, and I would reel, you know, put the reel on, and you had to change reels and all of that sort of stuff, change projectors. So I was quite good at that. But so I started watching films through the projection, through the little glass and the, you know, the reflecting of the light and all of that. And there was, to me, that's the sort of the magic of cinema. It's in Cinema Paradiso.
You just
get
it,
don't you?
Yes,
I mean, it's just brilliant, you know. And so I started, my mind started to open up a bit. But then because I sort of was into drama and then film and then moving out sort of happened, and it seemed only natural that it was based on an Italian sort of, you know, subject. It just, I guess the impetus for that was someone's asked me to write a script. I know absolutely nothing, so I'm going to write about what I know, you know, because then they can't tell me I don't know anything. You know? Right, so I know what goes on. And so it was through that that I started to discover that. And I guess when you start then looking at film, I remember seeing The Conformist very early, which was wonderful. But then I guess I started to identify with the Italian culture and the way in which they were speaking and things there, that it just seemed, when I say identify, it was very familiar to me. You know, so they were foreign films, but they were familiar. So then I started to soak them up, you know, like, you know, the Bicycle Thieves, you know, and then, you know, La Dolce Vita, you would see. And then I got into, you know, Bertolucci and 1900, you know. Oh, there's one great film, La Terra Trema. You know, it's an amazing, amazing film about a fishing village, you know, based on, and they were all non-actors. And there was, so I sort of got hooked in seeing this sort of very raw reality of the neorealist sort of filmmaking.
Yeah.
And then, of course, Sergio Leone just sort of blew my mind, you know, when I saw.
So they were like, lightning moments. There was Road to Damascus moments, like going bang. I remember when I saw Olmi's first film or whatever. Yeah. You basically said, that bang.
Yeah, I think so. There were things like that. And I can't quite remember sometimes where I saw it, you know, but I did go to the cinema and see some things. And other times I might have seen it when I was projecting it for someone, you know, in the film society or somewhere.
But,
you know?
But that's really very much about the magic of cinema and of films. The fact that you go, you sit there, and there is something that resonates so much with your experience. And sometimes it's not really just a straight line, but there are ideas or moments or emotions that resonate.
Were you just as affected by Japanese cinema? Were you just as affected by Russian cinema, or was there a special relationship
I think, with Italian. The Italian
that's
cinema? You know, like, I mean, I'd seen a couple of the Japanese things, and you go, oh yeah, well that's good, and I know, like, you know, Seven Samurai and all of those, and Rashomon and that, and and the experience of watching them to me felt a bit more objective.
Okay.
You know.
More academic in a way.
Yeah,
you know, you've got a distance,
you
recognize how good they are, but they don't talk to you directly, maybe.
Yeah, like, I think that's the case. And the word that you use two of my favorite words, which were resonate and magic. And to me, like in this era that we live in now, we're like with streaming, the thing that I still love, and it's brilliant that you can watch anything in it, but you're in your house, you're in your lounge room, you know, there's other stuff going on and you can stop it, you can start. There's nothing that replaces the sort of that, the magic of being transported into another world.
Absolutely.
In a cinema. And so that's always sort of, in a sense, not when I say how I've chosen projects, but if something sparks my imagination and I can see the magic from the audience point of view, to go back to your
question. I just wonder whether it's an actual cinema itself, because I'll give you the flip side to that. So The Castle was a great hit at the time at the cinema, but it became a massive hit on TV.
Yeah.
Basically, it was a slow burn at the cinema. It made about half as much money as The Dish made when it came out. But it took it 36 weeks, and it stayed in the charts for 36 weeks.
Wow.
So it was a slow burn.
Yeah.
You could never do that now.
No, these days it wouldn't happen.
But it became a lot more famous at home. And this is all anecdotal, because people do occasionally stop me or talk to me about it, that they watch it with their families.
Yeah.
You know, so it's not a solitary viewing. They say, once a year at Christmas, our family watches this, or, you know, so therefore, I guess it's a similar thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
I guess it is similar to saying it's still a communal experience rather than a solitary one.
Yeah. I think that there is that aspect of it, definitely with the castle. I mean, it's become that sort of, it's iconic, you know, in many ways. And it is that communal experience that I think that I worry about younger generations now that are on phones and watching this, and they're on the tram and they're watching that, and you go, you don't know what you're missing out on, you know.
One of the things that we talked about with Italian cinemas in Melbourne was very much about this communal experience. Everyone is together watching.
Yes.
And that was a very important, I think, aspect of what was happening at the time that in this cinema. And I'm sure that in the cinemas, the people would have been also talking.
Yes.
You know,
I
think you remember, Santo, there was a lot of cheering on. And that, I think, is a lot of sharing of what is on the screen.
It's like the coffee shops and the restaurants. Yeah. You know, they would go there because of the familiarity, and that's what we, you know, we like. We're a pack. You know,
I had to take my grandfather twice to Cinema Paradiso. He was a projectionist in a small town as well. Yeah. He spoke right through the first screen. He spoke right through it. I used to do that. He shouldn't put it. He's put it up the wrong way. And why is the kid? Oh, come on! You should let him do that. Why are they cutting? And shut up! And in the end, he said, "What happened?" And I said, "What do you mean? What happened? Didn't you see it?" I did, but I got a bit distracted, so we had to go twice. Yeah.
Brilliant.
Which is great. Jan, thank you so much for joining
us
today.
It's been a real pleasure.
I cannot believe what wonderful stories we've got, we've heard, and all the very best to you, and well done on a truly incredible career. And you're an absolute credit, not only to yourself, but on the people that came before you, your parents, your nonny. I'm sure they're smiling down at you right now. So well done, mate.
That's very good. Same to you, mate. Good on you. Thank you so much, all of you. Thank you.
You have been listening to Chop Tops and Cassata, an episode of The Secret Life of Language. Special thanks to our guest, Jan Sardi, and our producer and editor, Alice Garner. The Secret Life of Language is recorded and mixed at the Horwood Recording Studio by Gavin Nabel. It is a podcast from the School of Languages and Linguistics at the University of Melbourne. Chop Tops and Cassata would not be possible without the support of the Australasian Centre for Italian Studies. Be sure to keep up with every episode of The Secret Life of Language by following us on the Apple Podcast app, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. The Secret Life of Language is licensed under Creative Commons.